In the realm of true crime, every crime scene tells a story. Every story has its truths. These are the stories from inside the crime scene tape that separates fact from fiction. A surveillance camera recorded the shocking image of Patty Hearst wielding an M1 military carbine during a San Francisco bank robbery in 1974. 2 months earlier, members of the violent radical group the Symbionese Liberation Army, the SLA, had kidnapped the 19-year-old granddaughter of the late media baron William Randolph Hearst. Hearst was the inspiration for the 1941 film Citizen Kane. During the late 19th and 20th centuries, William Randolph Hearst media empire practiced sensational yellow journalism and swayed public opinion. It was said that his newspaper empire could start wars. His granddaughter, Patty Hearst, a college student born into wealth and opulence, appeared to have been transformed into a guerrilla warrior after 2 months of captivity. She called herself Tanya as she barked orders to customers during the bank robbery. Now, in 2024, on the 50th anniversary of the Hearst kidnapping, the debate continues about whether she became a willing member of the SLA or was brainwashed. A primary reporter covering the story was journalist Roger Rappaport. He's here with insights into one of the most bizarre and polarizing crimes in U.S. history. Rappaport has written a book simply titled Searching for Patty Hearst. I began our interview by asking why the SLA targeted 19-year-old Patty Hearst.
Well, the kidnappers were looking for someone that could get them money and media coverage. And they hit on this idea, which they got from the Tupamaros, another revolutionary group, that if they kidnapped the daughter of a media celebrity, that would be a huge boost for them. Obviously, they would get a big ransom. They'd also get a lot of publicity, and that would inspire other revolutionary groups around the country who wanted to get a jump start without having to do a lot of the legwork that's required to sell a point of view. And that was their idea. So when they learned that she was engaged to marry a philosophy student at the University of California named Stephen Weed, they decided that she would be an easy hit. There wouldn't be much security around her, which was true. And she was a 19-year-old that had met Steve Weed, her fiance, when he was her math teacher at a private school near San Francisco. At the time of the kidnapping, she was 19. Basically, nobody knew who she was.
And had Steve Weed and her started their relationship when she was much younger?
Yeah, she was 16. She was a junior at Crystal Springs School for Girls in Hillsborough, where she lived. They fell in love, had this secret affair. Then she finished high school a year early, went to junior college, and then together they moved to Berkeley. Her mother really wanted her to go to Stanford, and if she listened to her mother, we wouldn't be talking right now.
Rappaport says Patty Hearst's mother, Catherine, was a socialite who met Randolph when he was the publisher of the Atlanta Constitution. She was a wealthy Georgia debutante in 1938. Patricia Campbell Hearst was one of five daughters. A plain Jane, little makeup, she preferred t-shirts and cut-off jean shorts. 5 foot, 3 inches tall, 110 pounds, long, straight, light brown hair parted down the middle, 3 inches below her shoulders. Fair complexion, brown eyes, a wide grin. She looked like the average college girl of the 70s, indistinguishable from most girls of her age.
They lived in a 19-room house. They vacationed everywhere, but the family was going a lot, both for business and obviously pleasure trips as well. So she had a lot of independence very early. She also went to a Catholic boarding school, and that was kind of a rough ride. she had some struggles there and eventually decided to come home and go to this private school in Hillsborough. But at the time she was kidnapped, she was definitely apolitical. I know this is true because I wrote a book in 1974 with her fiance after she was kidnapped. And he lived in my house for many months while we wrote this book. And of course, he had access to the family and was involved after the kidnapping in her ransom effort. And one of the things we know for sure about Patty was that she crossed United Farm Worker picket lines. She thought her father's attempt to help the Latino community in the San Francisco area was kind of a joke. And she definitely had gone to school at Menlo College in the middle of the student strike. She just went to class. So our politics really weren't present.
According to Rappaport, Patty Hearst was not a spoiled rich girl. She paid her own rent while attending Berkeley, bought her own groceries, did her own cooking, took a semester off to work, and her father, Randolph, had taught her to shoot.
The California world, the San Francisco world, was far to the left of where her parents were. And this was a tricky thing because, obviously, as a newspaper publisher, you want to be in touch with your community. And at one point, she said to her dad, you know, Dad, nobody reads the San Francisco Examiner who's under 80. So she definitely understood that this privileged world that she'd grown up in was something that she didn't want to just remain in that situation.
Berkeley was the hotbed of America's leftist radicalism. By the early 70s, after years of protest and resistance, some fringes of the left were developing a sense of urgency. In the ever-present debate between nonviolent and violent actions, the idea of terrorism was gaining ground. Enter Donald DeFries, the founder of the Symbionese Liberation Army, known as the SLA, who had escaped from prison. The SLA's Marxist mission included ending racism, monogamy, and the prison system.
They were in Berkeley. I mean, everything was going on there. This was the final years of the Vietnam War. Watergate was happening. That was a big story. There was an energy crisis. There was a war in the Middle East. And, you know, the 60s had been, you know, a transitional time for San Francisco. So she was, you know, certainly part of that culture.
Yeah, I had a friend that was there at that time period, and he called it bizarrely, not Berkeley.
Uh-huh. Right.
And
exactly.
Were there a number of radical, you know, overthrow the government type groups popping up at that time?
Yes, and the SLA, which was founded by escapee from Soledad Prison, had in fact been working with one of those groups. A number of radicals from the Berkeley area had been involved in a prison reform group that was protesting the conditions in the prison. And so they had met a number of convicts during their trips to the prison in Vacaville and also Soledad, where DeFries escaped. So when he got out of prison, you know, when he literally just disappeared one night, he went back to Berkeley and hooked up with mostly these middle-class white kids and formed the SLA. Their first attempt to strike was the assassination of the Oakland school superintendent, who they felt was engaging in profiling of students with UCLA psychiatrists who were doing a study trying to figure out who was the most likely to become a criminal. That kind of profiling really got them upset. And that move was a disaster. Basically, they were denounced by everybody, including the left.
The SLA slogan was "Death to the fascist insect that preys upon the life of the people." It was a small band of violent misfits. Before kidnapping Hearst, they murdered Marcus Foster, the first African-American superintendent of schools in Oakland, California, with cyanide-tipped bullets, and wounded another school official. Armed with stolen weapons and funded by robberies, the group trained in military maneuvers in the Berkeley Hills. The SLA saw in Patty Hearst the means to catapult their cause into the national consciousness. She was a 19-year-old sophomore art history major at the University of California, Berkeley. On the evening of February 4th, 1974, around 9 p.m., Hearst and her fiancé were watching TV when there was a knock at the door of apartment number 4 at 2603 Benvenue Street in Berkeley. A trio of SLA members, described as commandos in newspaper coverage, burst into her apartment with guns drawn and beat her fiancé, Steve Weed, to a pulp. 3 months earlier, the San Francisco Chronicle published a story her parents commissioned, announcing the Hearst heiress' engagement to Stephen Weed. In the newspaper photo, Hearst sits with Weed standing behind her, with his left hand on her shoulder. He looks like a professor, wearing a sports jacket and an abstract pattern necktie. Wire-rimmed glasses frame his eyes. He has a manicured light brown mustache. He is a slim and slight figure. The age difference between the teacher and his former high school student was apparent. The newspaper article also disclosed Hearst's address. That caught the attention of the leader of the SLA, Donald DeFries, who was looking for his next target.
Well, believe it or not, despite who she was, there was basically no security at this house, almost none. And what happened was one of the members, who Angela Atwood, who happened to be an actress, knocked on the door and claimed that her car had broken down. And right behind her was Donald DeFries and Bill Harris. And they beat Weed, who started screaming. And then Bill Harris carried Patty out into a car. And then that was the beginning of her captivity period. She was bound and gagged, but she was much more under control. They were worried about Steve because his screaming, they felt, was going to alert the neighbors. And some of them actually did come out, but they fired some rounds to get them back into their apartment. But the crime scene was that they tore the house up, basically, which is interesting. I mean, they severely damaged the house in the process of kidnapping Patty.
And how long is it until they issue their ransom demand, and what do they want? How much money, and what do they want to do with it?
The initial demand was $4 million. Now, at that point, I suppose the family was in a position to just write the check, since it's a billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar corporation.
48 hours after the abduction, the SLA sent a hand-scrawled ransom note to Randolph Hearst, threatening to kill little Patricia unless you pigs let the pair of SLA members arrested for the murder of the Oakland school superintendent out of prison. The ransom note insisted that, quote, "I want you to put this in the news and in your newspaper, and if you don't, you might just be our next victim," end quote.
So the kidnapping was very easily done, but I think they guessed wrong on the hearse. And what happened was the governor, the attorney general, the hostage consultants all said to Patty's father, "Look, you ransom her and, you know, they'll be after other people's daughters, and they'll be bombing the Hearst headquarters. They might even go after San Simeon, which is the castle that her grandfather built. That's a major tourist attraction." And so this fear persuaded Randy Hearst not to ransom her. And that was the breakdown that basically contributed to Patty's decision to join the SLA.
The SLA issued a new demand for Hearst to give away $70 worth of free food to everybody in need in the state of California.
But that turned out to be a disaster. Some of the food was spoiled. People got attacked. TV reporters got attacked and so on. So it was kind of a riot. And that went very badly, even though the Hearst, you know, tried to comply with that part of the ransom. So that's when things began to break down. One of the things that I've learned since I started doing my author tour is that Randy actually was trying to do a back channel negotiation with some of the prisoners that knew the SLA leadership, with the goal being that they would somehow put pressure on the SLA to let Patty out. And so he was working quite hard in that regard. It didn't work. The dream was that Russell Little and Joseph Romero, who were the two SLA members who were arrested and in San Quentin for the murder of the Oakland school superintendent, the deal was that they went to the judge in that case, that is Randy himself and the head of the Department of Prisons, to try to get Little and Romero on a national television broadcast where they would actually appeal for Patty's release and then talk about their own case. But the judge said no. So Randy was trying to do it quietly, you know, through the back door. But that didn't work. So as time went on, Patty began to realize that the money wasn't forthcoming. So she just couldn't understand it, you know, and she saw it in the various communiques that she wrote under her own name. So both the SLA members and Patty issued communiques. And she very articulately kind of took down not just her family and the Hearst Corporation, but the entire power structure.
59 days after the kidnapping, Patty Hearst denounced her family in an audio recording called a communique sent to a radio station. And she claimed allegiance to the SLA, and she took the name Tanya. Tanya, or Tanya the Gorilla, was a communist revolutionary and spy who played a prominent role in the Cuban government after the Cuban Revolution and in various Latin American revolutionary movements.
And because she was an insider, she'd grown up in a privileged family, she had a lot of insight that these middle-class kidnappers did not have. And that was part of what resonated, you know, when her communiques went up on front pages of the Hearst newspaper and television and radio. Even though there was no social media at the time, she in effect was one of America's first social media stars. Every channel that you can imagine all over the world was endlessly covering Patty Hearst. I think there were 7 Newsweek covers. And the story was so big, this crime story was so big, that it knocked Watergate off the front page. Hard to believe it was bigger than the impeachment of the president.
Rappaport says the kidnappers did not like the heat that the Patty Hearst abduction was bringing down on them with her communiques.
They told her, they said, listen, we just want the money and we want the publicity. We don't want you because you're a liability. You know, if you stay with us, the FBI, the search is going to get bigger and bigger and, you know, we're much more vulnerable. But when she started writing these communiques explaining her point of view and why she was going to stay and fight, they all read them and said, listen, you know, this is crazy. I mean, what you're saying and attacking the pig Hearst, it's, nobody's going to believe it. You know, they're going to think we wrote it for you. You've got to tone it down. So they did. They actually convinced her to rewrite her communiques, which if you read them today, a lot of what she talked about, particularly on the feminist side, echoes the Me Too movement. Obviously, prison rights was in there, the Vietnam War.
Patty Hearst issued a series of audio communiques on cassette tapes left at radio stations and flower shops. Rappaport says Hearst denounced her fiancé and announced that she had fallen in love with one of her kidnappers.
And everybody's, you know, in the media thought, oh, well, this is just a, you know, contrived bunch of communiques. They're using her as a mouthpiece. But then a few weeks later, she was on camera in a bank robbery where the SLA successfully raided a bank owned by the father of a close childhood friend and walked off with $10,000. So now her picture was on post office walls.
I'll be back after this break. Hello, this is Robert, and I want to ask a small favor. Will you please tell your friends who love true crime to follow the True Crime Reporter podcast? As you know, it's one of the few podcasts where you can hear raw, unfiltered accounts from law enforcement experts, victims, and even convicted criminals. And please sign up for my free newsletter. The form is on every page of my website. Finally, I am so thankful to my Apple listeners who have given the podcast 5-star reviews. Your reviews on all of the channels are extremely helpful in spreading the word about this podcast. Now, back to our episode. The story, which was garnering national and international attention, took a shocking turn in April 1974, 2.5 months after her kidnapping. Hearst, a.k.a. Tanya, and 4 SLA members held up a branch office of the Hibernia Bank in San Francisco for $10,000. A surveillance camera captured Hearst brandishing a semi-automatic rifle on a sling over her shoulder and barking orders to customers. She did not try to hide her face, although she had dyed her hair dark. Patty Hearst suddenly became America's most famous revolutionary terrorist. The FBI had already launched one of its most massive, agent-intensive searches in history to find Hearst and stop the SLA.
Things were getting kind of hot after the bank robbery, so Donald DeFries knew a lot of people in Los Angeles, where he'd begun his criminal career, and he had a safe house there. And they divided into 3 teams. Bill Harris told me about this. And by the way, my interview with Bill, the one I did after he got out of jail, is in Searching for Patty Hearst. What happened was that Patty joined a team with the Harrises, And they went shopping. And during that event at a sporting goods store in Inglewood, Harris was being tackled by security guards for allegedly shoplifting. Patty was in a van across the street on the floor and heard the commotion and jumped up. And with an M1 that she was trained on and a machine gun that she was not trained on, she fired off about 80 rounds and the Harrises escaped. But that van was hot. So they went ahead and carjacked a teenager, abandoned the van, which had a parking ticket on it. And that parking ticket led the police to the safe house, which they had left by that point, but they quickly found a new safe house. So while the Harrises and Patty were on the run and carjacked this kidnapper, the SLA was being surrounded, and they checked into a motel, the three of them, in Anaheim across from Disneyland, and watched their six comrades be exterminated.
The Los Angeles Police Department SWAT team surrounded the SLA safe house in South Central Los Angeles. An officer announced over a bullhorn, "This is the LPD. Come out with your hands up and leave your weapons in the house." He repeated the message 25 times with no response, according to police. The half dozen heavily armed SLA members opened fire. 410 officers converged on the scene, many trying to control the 10,000 spectators drawn by live television news coverage of it. An estimated 9,000 rounds were fired during a furious two-hour gun battle. The house caught fire after officers shot tear gas rounds into it. Four of the SLA members were found dead beneath the house, including Donald DeFries, who had founded the SLA. Two others died attempting to escape. A police officer said they had pistols in each hand and went down blazing. It was like the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Everyone then asked, "Where is Patty? Was her body among the charred remains?"
At that time, it's hard to believe it, but no one knew if Patty Hearst was in that house, whether they had shot and killed Patty or not. It took days because tear gas canisters set the house on fire, which meant that they had charred remains that they had to examine. So the family had to wait for days to find out if Patty was, in fact, one of the victims.
The SLA was now down to three members: Patty Hearst, Bill Harris, and his wife, Emily. They split up and went on the run. Patty Hearst linked up with new converts to the SLA. The FBI worked 6 days a week in 12-hour shifts and checked out thousands of leads.
The FBI figured out that one way to track Patty was to check the records of all the new hookups, because they knew that, you know, wherever she was, she had to have power. And as they were going through the list of all the new PG&E subscribers, they found this place on Morse Avenue where somebody was stealing power. They hadn't actually put down a deposit or anything. They were literally pirating off somebody else's power supply. And that turned out to be where Patty was, literally. And so they began, you know, when they got there, they walked in and she said, you know, "Don't shoot." She had guns on the kitchen table. And then the Harrises were captured on the same day, living in another apartment nearby. They were actually out jogging when they were captured.
The FBI arrested Patty Hearst and charged her with bank robbery 19 months after her kidnapping by the SLA. When booked in, Hearst listed her occupation as urban guerrilla and raised a clenched fist in a revolutionary salute. At a sensational trial, Hearst, high-powered defense attorney F. Lee Bailey, tried to mount a defense that the young heiress was a victim, brainwashed and raped by her abductors. Well, the prosecutors played a jail cell recording of Hearst talking with a friend in which she was cursing and fully aware of her role with the SLA.
I was at the trial. Interestingly, I wrote for a Hearst newspaper, if you can believe that. And the trial was kind of a circus. Patty was quite defiant at the time. She was writing mash notes to Steve Celaya, one of the SLA members, when she was captured. And it was F. Lee Bailey's probably worst moment. He signed a fee agreement that gave him the book rights 18 months ahead of Patty's book, and then proceeded to just mount a brainwashing defense that just cratered in court. And then even worse, Willie Wolf, who she claimed had abused her, the guy that she, in her communiques, she said she was in love with. It turned out that she had a carved Olmec monkey stone carving in her purse that matched one that he'd been wearing on a necklace. And this was, you know, like 15 months after he died. Why is she still carrying this love token from a guy that she claimed abused her? And that really was devastating in the case. Just terrible.
Did she testify?
Yes, very badly. And it was a sort of an architected defense that Bailey kind of created for her, but she really had a hard time on the cross because of all this evidence that showed that, you know, far from being a victim that was forced to rob this bank, she deliberately went in front of the cameras on the security recordings to let people know that it was her, Patty, you know, that she, in fact, was not brainwashed, you know, that she had decided to voluntarily join this bank robbery. And that was the argument of the prosecution, and it worked.
Well, as a reporter, you're always kind of watching the jury. What was their reaction, and did any of them talk after the verdict?
Well, you'll love this story. There's a lot of debate about a lot of things, but this is absolutely true. The jury was selected in a private session, and not just Patty's parents, but the Hearst family was there on the jury selection. And the judge was a personal friend of Randy Hearst. He had known Patty as a young girl. So obviously the implication was that she was easily going to get off. And that was Bailey's assumption. That's why he signed this big book contract, because he knew he was going to make a lot of money after he won the case. But the jury, which obviously seemed to be favorable under a judge who knew the family, they just weren't buying her story.
Patty Hearst was sentenced to 7 years in the federal penitentiary. She served 2 years when President Jimmy Carter commuted her sentence.
Well, the Committee to Free Patty Hearst, which was a very extensive and well-financed rehabilitating Patty's image campaign after she lost in the trial and went to jail, they didn't just do a PR campaign. They actually got Cesar Chavez. Remember, I told you that Patty had walked through a United Farm Workers picket line.
Mm-hmm.
Cesar Chavez was one of the people who supported, even though she defied his union, he supported her being commuted. They got the head of the San Francisco FBI office, you know, that had been involved in arresting her. He wrote a letter in behalf of her. And believe it or not, Ronald Reagan, who at one point said during the free food program, "I hope all these poor people who get the free food from the ransom effort come down with botulism." He also supported it. Now, remember, Patty's mother was a regent at the University of California. Reagan had appointed her. So they got a lot of celebrities on board to support this commutation. And that worked quite well. And then as far as the pardon goes, the book and the movie and a lot of interviews she did, she was interviewing everywhere, telling her side of the story. And in his last official act in 2001, President Clinton pardoned Patty.
2 months after her release from prison, Hearst married a police officer who had guarded her while she was out on bail. They had 2 children together. Hearst turned 70 in February 2024. She has been in the news in recent years for her dogs, mostly French bulldogs, that have won prizes at the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show. Rappaport did not get an interview with her. During his book tour, new information has surfaced from witnesses to the abduction, which he updates on his website, pattyhearst.com.
I was doing a talk in San Francisco, and this woman had been writing to me about it. She came to the talk, and then she sent me an email. She was recruited by the SLA during their time in Berkeley and Oakland, and she went to a recruiting meeting. They were trying to get her to join. And she said it was unbelievably scary. There were weapons everywhere, the rhetoric and so on. And she obviously didn't join. But this was the climate of what they were trying to do. They would mask people, take them to secret meetings and so on. So they were struggling to find the right new membership. You know, everywhere they went, they were very, very heavily armed.
All these years later, 50 years later, what's your summation of what happened here?
Well, in Searching for Patty Hearst, I attempt to give the reader an opportunity to come to their own conclusions about what really happened. And that's really the point of the book, is I want the people who listen to your show to not just take any one person's word, not just for this case, but any case, and do their own homework, because I think that's the way you need to approach the world. And that's what journalists do.
Now, from my reporter's notebook, some closing thoughts. Was Patty Hearst a victim or a villain? Was Patty Hearst an impressionable college student who'd grown up in a sheltered, wealthy family, more vulnerable to her captors? Young adults in the midst of forming an identity and seeking a sense of purpose may be more susceptible to the allure of cults. The SLA fits the definition of a cult-like family. Or did her sense of abandonment by her family turn her into a true believer? 50 years later, the verdict of public opinion is still out. Patty Hearst's image, brandishing an assault rifle during the bank robbery, is forever seared into any discussion about her. This is Robert Riggs reporting. Please tell your friends who love true crime that they can bypass secondhand tales and get their true crime fix here with authentic stories straight from the source. Tell them that True Crime Reporter is one of the few podcasts where you can hear raw, unfiltered accounts from law enforcement victims and even convicted criminals. And sign up for my free newsletter on the homepage of truecrimereporter.com. It's your gateway to a world of knowledge and awareness in the realm of true crime and your personal safety. Thanks for listening, and until we meet again, be prepared. Don't get scared. This is Robert Riggs reporting.